Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
So Daniil Medvedev is the brand new US Open champion in his third Grand Slam final, his second against Novak Djokovic, his second of the year, in fact, against Novak Djokovic. And it couldn't have been more different to the first, played at the Australian Open earlier this year. Novak Djokovic fails to complete the calendar Grand Slam. He falls at the final hurdle with Rod Laver watching on, the last man to complete the calendar Grand Slam in 1969. He was there. He was poised to present the trophy in the event of a Djokovic win. I can tell you that Medvedev's win tonight, whilst many will celebrate it for many different reasons, it did deny us the opportunity to see Rod Laver walk onto court to the tune of Rocket Man.
Was that lined up?
That was in the script.
Wow.
For a Djokovic win.
Damn.
Sorry.
And it would have been an iconic photo.
Yes.
The last man to complete the calendar slam and the new man to complete the calendar slam. Like
it
a
would have
handover
been.
Moment.
In the event, we got a different photo. We got Stan Smith on the 50th anniversary of his 1971 win, a man that is not a shoe, as his autobiography title reminds us, although he is also a shoe.
He's both.
I'm not just a shoe. Yes, exactly. It's people think I'm a shoe, isn't it? That's his autobiography title, which is epic. Stan Smith presented the trophy to Daniil Medvedev while Novak Djokovic looked on in what must have been one of the most harrowing moments of his career, really. We'll delve into all of that. I mean, both Matt and I predicted a Novak Djokovic win last night, albeit an extremely narrow one, I think. We thought he would have to go to some dark places. David wasn't here to make his prediction. He's not here tonight, folks. He's still in recovery. He's all right. We're again in the position where he'll accept any and all well wishes. It's been a tough time for David. He wasn't able to do his commentary on the final today as he'd planned and hoped. And he is, in fact, stuck in a Holiday Inn in Salford, trying to rest up and get well. He'll be all right. Because he's David Law. But we wish him well and we'll miss him tonight, as we have on all the podcasts this fortnight, that illness has cruelly denied us his company. But I think David was going for a Djokovic win. I think we all countenanced the scenario in which Medvedev denied Djokovic tonight. I don't think any of us contemplated the scenario that played out. I think of all the scenarios, Djokovic in 3-4-5, Medvedev in 3-4-5, all the permutations therein, what we saw tonight felt like the least likely of them all, which I guess is very in keeping with the 2021 US Open, a real twist in the tail at the last, and yet still the match didn't feel in keeping with the 2021 US Open. It's all kinds of discombobulating somehow. And that's nothing to do with Medvedev winning, Djokovic not winning, any of that. It's more just the occasion and the moment and the match, I think, that's making us feel this way.
Yeah, I was very, very wary going into this tournament that the stress of what Djokovic was trying to achieve could be something that would derail him. You know, I'm pretty sure we spoke a lot about that in the lead up to this tournament. We all had him as the favourite, and we all thought he probably would manage it, but it was there. And I think we saw it along the way. He had a sort of bumpy ride to the final, didn't he? Lots of quite close matches, some stressful moments. But honestly, the fact he made it to the final, and given that real sort of statement of intent that he finished his semi-final with, and that line about playing it as though it's the last match of his career and putting his all into it, it convinced me that he would be able to handle what he was going for. And I thought he would embrace it, and it would be a sort of unstoppable force pulling him along. And as well as Medvedev would play, I just thought Djokovic would dig deeper and do enough to win. But actually, I think what we saw was the occasion weighing him down and pretty much sort of paralyzing him and not allowing him to play his game. In his words, he was below par with everything. In his press conference afterwards, he said that. And it's pretty hard to argue with that, really. He said his legs felt dead.
They looked dead, didn't they? He looked stuck in the mud.
There was a moment when he whacked his thighs with his racket, and Jim Courier said in the Prime video commentary, that's a sure sign of fatigue and your legs not responding in the way you want them to. He just couldn't get them going, and he reverted to serve volley a lot of the time, and he came forward to the net, and sometimes he did it well, but it's just not his game, and it was just a sign that he wasn't feeling good. And, you know, there were little outbursts as well, a massive racket smash, a moment where he almost thumped the ball into the crowd and restrained himself from doing it. You know, it was stress. And I think he went two sets to love down against Tsitsipas at the French Open, didn't he? And this just had a totally different feel to that match. It never felt like likely that he would mount a comeback. Just, you know, energy wise, and he said this in his press conference as well, against Tsitsipas, when he got a break in the third set, he kind of knew the comeback was on. He knew deep down that it wasn't on today. He just didn't have it in him. And I think you can speculate that an extra almost 6 hours on court than Medvedev played a part. But he wasn't giving that much blame to that. I think it really was the stress of what he was trying to achieve. And once it was all over, he said what he felt was relief that it had finished. And it was clearly, clearly weighing on him so much.
I have to say, that was my feeling. There was a lot of talk. Like I mentioned it in my questioning to our various pundits on Prime Video about the 5.5 hours extra that Djokovic had spent on court versus Medvedev. But it didn't look like that kind of fatigue to me today. Added to that, the fact that Novak Djokovic has had far more grueling runs into a Grand Slam final than this, far more grueling. You know, we saw him beat Andy Murray in 5 sets at the Australian Open, and less than 2 days later, come back and win a 6-hour final against Rafael Nadal that left one of the physical colossuses of sport bleeding in the locker room.
I mean, he's older now, Djokovic.
He's older.
He's still in supreme physical shape.
Yeah.
And the days off, I think, help massively with recovery.
Absolutely. And it just didn't look like that kind of fatigue. It wasn't... It didn't present itself in the longer rallies. There was no correlation between length of rally and volume of fatigue. Which is how that kind of fatigue, I think, generally presents itself, looking out of puff. And he just looked leaden, absolutely leaden. And Yeah, that we know more now about the interaction of the mental and the physical, don't we? And we understand that, you know, it's not just a question of, you know, oh, I'm feeling stressed. That is a sensation that exists entirely from the neck up. But goodness me, it must have been what an awful feeling to be out of control of your own body, the way it seemed that he was tonight. I was trying to think of some kind of layperson comparison, like when you're so tired that you can't sleep. That was all I could think of. Just sort of, why? Mm. Why are you doing this to me? Why are you betraying me like this? My head is saying, all I need is sleep. Body, I'm letting you sleep. Why aren't you doing it?
And usually that's because you've got something on your mind.
Absolutely. It must have felt like such a betrayal. And there was a moment, wasn't there? 4-5 down in the third set. Medvedev had been 5-1 up. He had served for it at 5-2. He got so tight. I think there were certainly two double faults in that game. Were they both on championship point? Certainly one was.
There was one on championship point and then one on deuce, the next point.
Yeah, it was tight.
I thought he should have underarmed.
Oh, we all did, Matt. We all did.
I also think he had a brief moment of thinking that. And that's pure speculation, but
do you
he
think
did have
he
a little look.
Underarm serve and volley, now's the time. Right. It served me well at the French Open. Sort of
suicide run to the net.
Yeah, that it was what the match needed at that point, wasn't it? So Djokovic breaks him back, and Djokovic didn't do a whole lot to break him back. He asked the question. He hung in there and asked the question, and we're talking about a set in which, you know, there was a moment when bagel set was crossing people's minds. So just hanging in there at this point, extraordinarily, was a real feat of resilience for Novak Djokovic. Then he holds, and then it's a sit down at 5-4. So Djokovic is 4-5 down. Medvedev is about to come out and try to serve for it again. And Djokovic buries his face in his towel. And at first it looks like he's just mopping up the sweat, as is normal. And then you realise his chest is heaving. And he is sobbing into the towel, his face contorted in despair. And I have never seen anything like it, Matt. I have never seen anything like it. And again, we probably need David here for his slightly longer memory. But yeah, look, we've seen tears on a tennis court. We've relived a lot of tears on a tennis court, but I've never seen those kind of tears, and certainly not from that player.
It was extraordinary. I'll never forget that change of ends. And I think there was a lot happening, wasn't there? There was a combination of things. There was the realization, I think, that it was slipping away, that it was, you know, kind of gone. Okay, he was still in the match, but he was on the brink of defeat, something he's worked so hard for. And there was also the incredible reception he was getting from the crowd during this changeover. He was touching his heart and thanking them, and they were behind him like a crowd has never been behind Novak Djokovic before. And the whole topic of Novak Djokovic and crowds is one
PhD worthy.
Totally. And I sometimes feel bad about bringing it up in a way, because it feels like there sort of should be more to talk about. And so often it hasn't actually impacted the result of the match. And yet it is a very important factor in the Novak Djokovic story. I actually said to you a few days ago that I thought a sort of glorious defeat in the final here could end up being the sort of moment which endears Djokovic to the tennis masses in a way that hasn't happened before, because losses humanize you. You know, ask Roger Federer, ask Andy Murray, and just in terms of players from this era. And he's had losses, Djokovic, of course he has. He's had some tough ones, but not with this much agony and not with this much on the line and this much raw emotion visible to everyone. It was slightly reminiscent of the prolonged applause he got after the 2015 French Open when he lost to Wawrinka. And he'd never won the French Open before, and they gave him this incredible reception. But this was more than that. And look, there is something a bit cruel, I think, about what he had to give up for him to get that support. I mean, they were supporting him from the start, I think. They were behind him. They wanted to see history. But it was seeing him lose that actually really turned them massively in favour of him, and seeing what it meant to him, seeing that emotion. And Djokovic has kind of had everything in his career except that love of the crowd. And it's a nonsense if people say that doesn't matter to him. It has mattered to him. He has craved it. Sometimes I think he's denied it. And as I said, it hasn't always had an effect on the outcome of matches. But
the media sometimes get accused of amplifying and exaggerating that narrative for our own ends, don't
exactly.
we?
That's what I mean about sort of sometimes hesitating to bring it up, because, you know, you just get piled on by Djokovic fans. But his actions have always been really telling. You know, the way he stopped doing the impersonations, the way he does that celebration to the crowd, you know.
But didn't crucially after the two matches this tournament when he received the most negative reception from the crowd, arguably very unfairly from the New York crowd, but you know, he noticed and he responded.
Absolutely. And all of Djokovic's quotes after the match, both in his on-court speech and in his press conference, confirm that it matters to him. It really matters to him.
And that's fine.
Completely fine. It's
we
great.
We all want to be loved.
Yeah. Totally. And look,
that's the most human thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And some of the quotes are extraordinary from Djokovic, you know, talking about real gratitude for the crowd and how they sort of touched his soul and genuinely gave him a positive feeling on the night, which was one of the toughest of his career. He did win something tonight. He didn't win probably what he thought he wanted the most, which was the Calendar Slam. But that reception he received, I think, has fueled him and has helped him in a way that he didn't realise was possible, because he's never had something like that before.
And do you feel sure that it's more than just clinging, more than just looking for a positive in a sea of despair?
I do. I feel positive that what he experienced tonight mattered to him a lot. What I don't feel that positive about is whether it will carry over, whether it will last. I think it might. As I said, I think it could be the moment where the sort of tennis viewership changes their opinion of Djokovic a little bit, or some of them. I mean, he's obviously got... I've always thought Djokovic has the third most amount of fans in men's tennis. You know,
yeah.
He does have a lot of fans, of course he does. But you know, it's no secret that he's been way behind Federer and Nadal in that conversation. So yeah, I do think it mattered deeply to him tonight to receive that.
The celebration from Daniil Medvedev. So many aspects of it warrant talking about.
I think Medvedev's whole performance we need to talk more about as well.
Yes. Can I start with the celebration,
please,
though, and
then
we can work backwards? he did a celebration. did you know what it was? What it was what the reference point was at the time that he did it?
No.
No, okay, great. I don't feel 100 years old then. So did you know at the point that Medvedev gave the clue?
Yes.
Oh.
When he gave the clue, I thought, oh, well, that's a FIFA thing. Because I know he likes FIFA and I know you can do specific celebrations on FIFA.
Right.
I mean, I laughed out loud when he did it. It was hilarious.
The celebration?
The celebration.
It was great.
What I loved is how he committed to it.
Yes, it would have been dire had he not committed to it. I mean, the most cringe thing that's ever happened. Yeah,
he said
he did face and everything.
The face is brilliant. It's called the dead fish.
Oh well, I can absolutely see why.
I think I might just call Medvedev dead fish from now on.
So he did that, and that was wonderful. You know, bloke's just won his first Grand Slam title.
He's and he doesn't beaten normally the world celebrate.
And he doesn't normally celebrate. So it was completely apt that to break that no celebration rule. It should be for something epic.
Yeah. And he said it came to him at Wimbledon.
Oh, he'd been planning it.
He'd been planning it. And he was thinking of doing it at Wimbledon. He said, I'm in really good form. And he said, in sort of one night, I couldn't sleep. And
I was having thoughts.
And I thought, if I win Wimbledon, I'm going to do that celebration. And the reason he thought it would work at Wimbledon is because the grass is soft. And
yeah,
he has to
also,
sort of leap.
The centre court crowd is not the one for that.
No, true. And he said he hurt himself doing it today. He committed so much, he injured himself.
So that happened, and it was epic, and it was brilliant. But then it was pretty muted, wasn't it? Mm. And he actually sat down in his chair, looked over at his box, and he did a sort of just quieten down, just keep a lid on it motion. And he himself, you know, he was smiling broadly and looked extremely happy. But there was a restraint about all of the celebrations. And I think that was an acknowledgement of and mark of respect towards Djokovic. And I thought that was fantastically classy.
Yeah, me too. And then he said something in his speech as well, which he's never said before, which was that he thinks Djokovic is the greatest player of all time. I've been in press conferences with Medvedev where he's been asked his opinion on the GOAT debate, and he has never given an answer out of respect, because I'm sure he holds them all in such high regard. And, you know, he just didn't want to get into that conversation. But he said it unprompted tonight. And as I think that was a real mark of respect for Djokovic. And he said in his press conference again that his tactical conversation with his coach before a match normally is about 2 minutes. You know, they don't really talk tactics that much. But against Djokovic, 30 minutes, which it doesn't even sound that long, does it? But, you know, 15 times longer. He says it's just unique playing Djokovic. The things he can do, the things you have to be prepared for. He rates Djokovic so much. And the fact that he's got a win over him in a Grand Slam final when he's going for all that history just makes it all the sweeter, I think, for Medvedev.
So what did he do tactically tonight? Because even with Djokovic in the state that he was in, I felt throughout, okay, no, not throughout, perhaps not in the third set, but I felt pretty much throughout the second set, and I still feel this way upon reflection, that had Djokovic been able to get a foothold in the match, and that's a big if, I realise, had he got that foothold, had he had a moment or a release of some sort that would have loosened him up, the whole thing could have been different. Not necessarily a different result, but different type of match altogether. And Medvedev made sure that he never got that foothold. And that was brilliant tonight.
Yeah, I thought he was fantastic, actually, Medvedev. Look, he recognised that Djokovic did not have a good day. And he said, look, when we played in Australia, Djokovic was great, but I didn't have a good day. And there's always two sides to a tennis match. And yes, Djokovic wasn't great today, but Medvedev really, really was. He played the role of the party pooper, the spoiler, just brilliantly.
He's perfect for that role,
perfect
isn't he?
Perfect role.
Just did not give two hoots about... Yeah. And yet was perfectly... but did give two hoots after he'd won it.
Exactly. It's
gave
just
many
what
hoots.
You want.
Yeah.
Yeah. And look, we don't learn much from pre-match interviews, I don't think. But
today...
And
yesterday, actually, looking back,
Interesting. I haven't thought about yesterday's.
Raducanu definitely looked the more relaxed in those two interviews. Everybody said it at the time.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I watched the two tonight and I thought Djokovic was breathing really heavily and looked quite nervous, whereas Medvedev said, I like my chances. I need to do better than Australia. And I actually think that experience that he had in Australia ended up helping him tonight, because he knew that was the sort of worst case scenario and he knew he could do better. He was prepared for that. And I felt it was a little bit of a combo of the ways he's beaten Djokovic in the past. On the one hand, he was really tough in rallies and just going toe-to-toe and, as exactly as you said, saying, I'm not going to lose these rallies. You're going to have to beat me. And the depth and the accuracy on his shots, it was all there. And I think he knew he probably maybe had a bit of a physical edge as well. But then also, he was gambling on his second serve and going for it on that shot in the way that we saw him do in Cincinnati when he beat Djokovic a couple of years ago. And I mean, his serve the whole match was imperious. Djokovic, widely regarded as the best returner of all time, barely got a look in.
It made sure that Djokovic couldn't get any rhythm going. If he played one brilliant return point and you thought, oh, right, Djokovic is showing up now, ace.
Yeah.
All rhythm gone, all momentum, all the things that we know Djokovic for, the way he can just turn a tide. You need momentum for that. It's a process. And Medvedev was able to shut it down at every stage. Ace, unreturnable serve, just snuffed out.
Yeah. And yeah, totally. And he also returned the Djokovic second serve brilliantly. I mean, he sort of dismantled it in a way that normally Djokovic does to his opponents. I think the biggest credit I can give Medvedev is that an element of this match, which was sort of the thing that was talked about the least, because Djokovic was the protagonist of it, I suppose, and was consuming all the oxygen in terms of how people talked about this match. But Medvedev was going for his first Grand Slam title. That is a very, very big deal. And yet, other than when he went to serve it out at 5-2, I barely thought about that. Mm-hmm. It just didn't feel relevant. It didn't feel like the occasion was getting to him at all. He just did his thing, stayed in his zone, and just delivered a really, really strong performance. And that final game, with all that was going on, you know, it was brilliant the way the crowd showed their appreciation and love for Djokovic. It was a shame, I thought, that it spilled into booing during Medvedev serving and during that game. But I know I think he hit one double fault in that game, didn't he? But overall, he really played a brilliant final game and held it together very, very composed amid a sort of circus around him.
One sliding door, a mini sliding doors tennis for you here, Matt, one scenario. I think in Medvedev's first service game of the second set, I think it was love one of the second set, Djokovic had love 40. And Medvedev won 5 points in a row to hold that game. I know ifs and buts, all the rest of it, there's no point. But but if he had won one of those.
Well, Djokovic said that was a turning point. You know, I mentioned him not having the confidence that he had in the French Open final when he went down 2-0. But he did say that the start of the second set was the moment where, if he was going to turn it around, it was right there. But I thought Medvedev saved them, really. I mean, that there was an incident, wasn't there, where they had to replay a point because some music or something came over the sound system. Or...
yeah, a Jumbotron malfunction, which gave all of us an opportunity to say Jumbotron today. Second time I've said it. Brilliant. Yeah, Djokovic probably less pleased about it, but me, delighted.
and that came, I think, in between Medvedev's first and second serve. So they replayed the point. Medvedev got another first serve, which he actually missed. So it did reset with a second serve. And then from memory, Medvedev played a brilliant backhand up the line to save that break point. But yeah, I think there's always a moment in a match, especially a best of five set match, where it could have turned. And almost always, and that was probably it. But wow, I mean, Medvedev, not many players beat a big three member in a Grand Slam final. He's joined Murray, Del Potro, and Wawrinka. They're the only ones. As Medvedev would say, legends only.
What was it? L2 shift left?
L2 plus left.
Plus left.
Dead fish.
There was a brilliant tweet by the brilliant writer Jerry Nathan. Yeah, a couple of tweets actually said, imagine the pain of losing the calendar slam to a guy who reminds you with his final words that he is a gamer. The ultimate fate of the millennial. Reach the peak of your craft only to be obsoleted by vloggers and shit posters. With apologies there to David's mum, obviously. But yeah, it's so... I mean, and Medvedev's 7 years older than the person that won the women's title yesterday. And yet, this is the first time since 1990 that we've had maiden champions, maiden Grand Slam champions in both the men's and the women's at the US Open. And that was Sampras and Sabatini. So... I don't want to fall into the same trap that I fell onto on Prime Video earlier of trying to say changing of the guard without saying changing of the guard. A new dawn, a new era. I'm not saying that Novak Djokovic is going anywhere and not going to be the favourite for the Australian Open. Of course he is. He'll be going for a 10th title there unless he, you know, takes a fall between now and then. But still, he will be the favourite. But will the feel of tennis be significantly different going forward now? Will Novak Djokovic be the outlier? The outlying member of tennis's past that is forcing his way into the present rather than the future that is forcing its way into the present? It's late, folks. Yep. None of that quite worked.
No, I get it. I think the difference will come if he's the only one of the big three. I've always held this theory about the big three as pack hunters. And I think when there's only one of them in the draw, it just makes it harder for them to win it.
Well, Nadal is currently on crutches.
Nadal is on crutches. Federer, we've not seen a picture of him, but he said he was going to be on crutches for weeks, so, didn't he? So he kind of is the only one. And yeah,
Andy Murray is playing a challenger event in Rennes.
Yeah, look, big believer in the big four, but I said big three for a reason. The balance of power is still with Djokovic. It has to be, based on what he's done this year at the Grand Slams. But it was pretty extraordinary that he won certainly two of the Slams that he did this year. Australia was a big struggle for him, and the French Open was a massive struggle for him in terms of coming from two sets down twice, beating Rafael Nadal. He knew this was a now or never situation for the calendar slam. He knows he's not going to be hoovering up Grand Slam titles. I'm pretty sure he will win more. But, you know, we've heard Zverev talk about the belief he gained from beating Djokovic at the Olympics, and he ran him far closer off the back of that than he ever has before in a Grand Slam. And you feel like Medvedev will gain belief from this. I think he had a real aura, Djokovic, post-Wimbledon, didn't he? But he's, you know, he's gone to two events that he set his sights on winning, and he hasn't won them. And that has to have some impact. I think so, anyway. Just, I should say, I had tweeted earlier that, okay, Djokovic has come up short in terms of completing the Grand Slam, just as Serena did 6 years ago. But what a thrill to have both of them go for it, you know, in our memory. I think the last time it happened was Martina Navratilova in 1984, trying to get the Grand Slam. She completed three of four. She already had won seven in a row.
Yeah. Unreal.
She went into that tournament on a 70-match winning streak.
Unreal.
And it was Australia, and it wasn't such a big slam. You know, it didn't have the same prestige, and there wasn't all the press attention on it. So really, these two from Serena and Djokovic are the ones since Steffi Graf in 88. And, you know, I massive respect for what they did. You know, there's glory in the chase as well as in the final catch. And yes, they both wanted to do it, but they both enhanced their greatness on that quest.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so beautifully put. I'll tell you what, Matt, two golden slams were completed today. Two. And one of them was followed by, okay, not the moment of the tournament, because Emma Raducanu, moment of the millennium, but definitely second best moment of the tournament. Dylan Alcott defeated Niels Vink, the unseeded Dutchman, today, 7-5, 6-2, in the wheelchair quad singles final to win the Golden Slam. Now, Dylan Alcott is a massive deal in Australia, isn't he? I think after he won that Olympic gold, his face was projected onto the Sydney Opera House, or perhaps his name. Wow. Something about Dylan Alcott was projected onto the Sydney Opera House. He's big potatoes. He's cool. He's really cool. He's part of the TV coverage often of the Australian Open in Australia. And there was a lovely moment in the early-ish stages of the first set of the men's singles final when all of the wheelchair champions that had competed today were lined up on the first tier of the Arthur Ashe Stadium, and the camera was on them, and they were introduced and waved to the crowd. Dylan Alcott, Matt, took his moment of the sun.
And then some.
And then some. Talk us through it.
Well, he had... Was it the trophy he had with him?
Yep. Or receptacle.
Yes.
For beverage.
Yeah. And he had a beer. Mary Carillo apparently said on the American coverage, I don't think that's his first beer today. And he poured it into the receptacle and chugged it.
Chugged it.
And he says he always chugs beer after he wins Grand Slams.
Not like that.
But
he's
never done it in front of on the Arthur Ashe Stadium in front of 20,000 people.
It was a sort of, oh, is he? Right. Again, similar to Medvedev, he committed to it.
Totally.
And that is what mattered. And wow. If you can't do it after you've won a Golden Slam, I don't know when you can. Dida de Groot also completed the Golden Slam today. She beat Yuikimiji 6-3, 6-2. No chugging, though.
No, she was a spectator.
She'll have to do it again and get her chugging moment in the sun. But extraordinary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Shingo Kaneda won his 25th Grand Slam singles title. 25th, folks, 25th. He beat Alfie Hewitt 6-1, 6-4 in the final of the wheelchair men's singles. He's 37 years old, is Shingo Kaneda. And speaking of 37-year-olds that won titles today, Sam Stosur and Zheng Shuai won the women's doubles title. They beat Makoko in three sets. Coco Gauff, Katie McNally, who were, well, Coco Gauff certainly was disconsolate in that defeat. I mean, just joyful scenes with Zheng and Stosur. Joyful. I love them. It reminded me of how wonderful it was when they won the Australian Open title a couple of years ago. They recaptured that and it was all just delightful. But it was quite a tough scene with Coco Gauff and Katie McNally, that. And I sort of loved how tough a scene it was and how desperately they wanted to win that. But it took me aback a bit, actually.
Yeah, me too. I thought Katie McNally was wonderful in her love and support of Coco Gauff.
Yeah.
You know, in that moment. She just said all the right things and just, you could tell she meant them. They really are a great team. They're great friends. And it was a little bit relived, wasn't it, in terms of everyone saying, you will be back in this final, you will get a chance again. I really notice when people say that now at trophy ceremonies.
People with plates being told they will win multiple Grand Slam titles.
It was a great match, I thought. Gauff and McNally were a bit sort of slow out the blocks, but then really got the crowd involved. A bit of a sparse crowd, but really got them involved in the second set when they turned that around and won it. And they had chances to go up a break at the start of the third and just couldn't quite take them. I think the nature of the match probably did influence how Coco Gauff was feeling. You know, it did perhaps feel like one that got away, but what a team Stosur and Shuai are. I mean, I really think Stosur is underrated.
Underrated, agrees. 16 years since she won her first.
16 years. She's won slams in all the disciplines, mixed doubles, singles and doubles, of course. She played 5 Olympics. She's been Aussie number one for, I don't know, over 400 weeks or something. Obviously a French Open runner-up as well as a US Open champion. And just a great role model and just a great person to have in tennis, I think.
And as we discovered today in Coco Gauff's speech, which she delivered brilliantly despite being so desperately upset. And it was funny, she really looked like a young girl, didn't she, in those moments. It was, I don't want to say immature, that's far too harsh, but there was a real rawness to it, wasn't it, that was very 17-year-old. And why not? She's a 17-year-old. She's never been in a Grand Slam final before. But she told Sam Stosur and everybody watching and listening that Sam Stosur was the first ever tennis autograph that she got. And that was lovely.
Really was. Yeah. Lovely,
it was lovely. A really lovely moment. Not as good as Dylan Alcott chugging his beer, but one of the great moments of today. Yeah. And that's it.
Oh.
That's the US Open 2021. What else can we talk about, Matt, so it doesn't have to end? Don't let it end.
No. What a tournament.
What a tournament.
And a surprising one in so many ways. I really did come into this tournament with some apprehension. You know, all of the women's slams in recent memory have been great. Truly, sort of developing in unexpected ways and some great matches. And with the men's event, I just really thought only the sort of Djokovic slam story would be what sustained it. And there was just so much going on in both draws. I will always remember this tournament. I will always remember Andy Murray versus Stefanos Tsitsipas on the very first day, with the sort of aggro, seeing Andy Murray play like that again. I think it's probably got lost in that story. Then we had Carlos Alcaraz doing his thing and emerging as a star. We had Leila Fernandez, four matches really in a row: Osaka, Kerber, Svitolina, and Sabalenka.
Four matches of the tournament, really.
One after the other. She lit up New York. She was incredible. Just in a way that I think was unexpected to her, to be honest. And just playing with such joy. It amazing to watch her. Obviously, the Djokovic story did end up sustaining the men's event. And that was epic to follow. And then Emma Raducanu.
Emma Raducanu. It really happened, didn't it?
It happened. It really did.
Yeah. When will... I think I'll think about that every day for... Don't know. When will be... I don't know. It's... yeah, I'll never forget it. I'll never forget any of this. Yeah, we ran our closing montage on Prime Video earlier. And it roughly ran in chronological order with a bit of editorial license at the end to end on Emma Raducanu, obviously. And it started with all the Murray Tsitsipas stuff. And I was like, God, do you remember when toilets were the biggest feature of this?
We talked about toilets for four days
and thought, let's cling to this toilet story because it's, you know, it's great. It's a story. And then, like, stuff started happening and we dropped toilets like a hot potato, didn't we? Goodness me. And, yeah, it's been everything, hasn't it? It's been absolutely brilliant. The only disappointment of it, I think, for us is that we haven't been able to record as many podcasts just as the three of us.
Mm.
And I mean David in that, not Billie Jean, who is...
She might be glad the US Open is over in terms of the amount of tennis that's been on the telly. Poor Billie Jean.
Yeah. I don't think she will be glad the US Open is over because it means that Matt's going home and I think that's going to be crushing for her tomorrow. But
for both of us.
Yeah. She's learnt a lot about the resilience and commitment and insomnia required to be involved in the tennis world. And whether you like it or not, Billie Jean, you are involved in the tennis world. Yeah, no, I obviously mean David. And yeah, we've had some joyous podcasts, the three of us. But yeah, it's we've not been able to share it all together as much as we would have liked. And sorry to you for that. And that's the listener, not you, Matt. Although also sorry to you because you've been the mainstay.
I know. I need to slip back into my cozy number three role.
Never. You can never go back to a cozy number three role with hot takes about Karen Khachanov.
That's a shame for everyone.
God, when was the last time you thought about Karen Khachanov? Anyway, I think what's happening here is I'm just trying to drag the end bit out because I don't want this all to be over. It has been just such a treat. It's been special. Thanks for coming on the journey with us. yeah, we really appreciate your company and bearing with us while we've not all been able to be on every show. I hope we've captured it all as best we possibly can. I know Matt certainly has. And goodness me, yeah. Anything else, Matt? Do I have to bring this train into the station?
I think if David were here, he would say, very importantly, thank you to our Kickstarter backers.
Yes.
And if you have enjoyed these podcasts, we will be crowdfunding again at the end of the year. And there's a link in our show notes where you can sign up for an email reminder when we go live. And we would obviously appreciate your backing.
It's like he's here.
He would say it with more enthusiasm than that.
I've got a way to drag this out, actually, with a rant about the predictions.
Yes, please. Oh, yes.
I haven't won, have I, Matt?
You have not won, no. You have come second. But Chris Albert Lee, who's been downgraded to mediocre bloke.
Sticking by that.
He has won with I'm pretty sure, a record-breaking score. This is in our newsletter.
But I think mine is also a record-breaking score.
Yeah, you're right.
The injustice of it, Matt.
Yeah. In another era.
If we know anything about sport, it's that timing is everything. And that defeat is crushing. So Novak Djokovic and I are experiencing very much similar emotions tonight. Get out the violins for both of us. I think that's it, except for the formalities, which is that Zeus and I have been cruelly denied victory by Chris Albert Lee, mediocre / top bloke. Rogue is David's mascot. You came nowhere near anywhere resembling a podium, but well done, Rogue, anyway. Get well soon, David. Matt and Scousel Matzel, where did you finish?
Fifth. Bad tournament.
Is that second from bottom?
Yeah.
Are you dressing that up? You've dressed that up, yeah. Who did finish bottom?
Lovely Guillermo.
Oh, right. I was hoping it was David. I didn't mean to shame Guillermo there. Sorry. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King. She is just cuddled up to Matt for the final moments of this podcast. Chris Albert Lee is generally a top bloke. It's just, generally you're a top bloke, Chris Albert Lee. Francis has been our lovely US Open mascot, handsome, handsome cat. Thank you for listening. Thank you to all of our Kickstarter backers for making this possible. We'll be back with more tennis podcasts soon. We're never far away, don't you worry. David will be back. The three of us will be back together. We'll be making podcasts at normal hours of the day, and tennis will be great again. We'll see you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.